for me, in my heart, I truly believe there is no cancer-free if there's no Make-A-Wish for me. And there is no healing, there is no recovery, there is no reconciliation of why without Make-A-Wish. So I cannot tell my cancer story without telling my Make-A-Wish story.
Welcome to the World of Wishes podcast. I'm Make-A-Wish Southern Florida's Chief Operating Officer, Richard Kelly. If this is your first time listening to this podcast, welcome. We hope what you hear today will inspire you to continue your support of Make-A-Wish and the children we serve. We've had a lot of great guests since we started, and today's is no different. I speak with Wish alumnus Marina Diaz, who credits her wish with giving her the motivation to fight during her battle with cancer. Her story is one of strength, resilience, and determination in the face of some pretty monumental health challenges. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Marina, I'm just so happy to be able to talk to you, talk about your wish, talk about your journey, and talk about what you're doing in your life now.
I'm really grateful to be here. Thanks for having me.
So your wish was granted back in 2008, but your medical journey started before then. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a little about your childhood and you know, up to sort of the preteen stage of your life, and then, you know, we'll get to you know, how your medical journey changed.
Yeah, absolutely. My preteen and childhood was pretty perfect. I grew up in California and then moved to Florida at a young age for tennis. So I started playing tennis when I was 2. I was taking lessons when I was 4, playing tournaments when I was 6, and I was nationally ranked by the age of 10. I trained where Serena Williams and Venus Williams trained. I played 6 hours a day, and my whole entire life was tennis. I was extremely healthy and fit, as you can imagine, and I think I can say it now because I didn't end up being a champion, but I was on my way to being a professional tennis player and what everyone was hoping and thinking, a world champion. So really beautiful life, an amazing family, and really a lot of fun. Like, every weekend was outside playing and winning, and then all of a sudden it wasn't.
What was that? What was the moment for you that you said this doesn't feel right?
That's a great question. I was sitting on the couch. We'd had Chinese food. I will never forget. That was a Sunday night. We were sitting on the couch. I had Chinese, and I just took a breath and I felt like a pain in my chest. And it was the big, and I was like, whoa, that doesn't feel good. And I was 15. So what do I know about heartburn? But I was like, sounds like heartburn to me. So I kind of was like, Mom, you know, my chest hurts, and just kind of kept breathing, but it didn't feel normal. And then I went to bed that night, and I woke up maybe like 2 or 3 in the morning with a gasp, like I couldn't breathe. And I remember crawling out of the top bunk of my loft, and I crawled to my parents' room and I pulled my dad's sheets, and I was like, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. And that was the day that we went to the hospital and they did scans. They sent me home, said I had bronchitis, and they were like, you're fine. There's a little phlegm in your chest. So like 7, 8 a.m., we went home, and at 10, they called my mom and said we'd like to see her back and do some more, just to be sure. And my life changed after that. 3 weeks later is when I was officially diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma. That was New Year's Eve. So not a great way to start the new year at all. No. And I remember them also saying, you have Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I was like, what's that? And the doctor just dead looked at me in the face and said, that's cancer. And then, of course, you think, I'm dead. That was my first thought. I'm going to die now.
What was it? So you had pain in your chest, in your mm-hmm. stomach, and was it getting worse? I mean, what was the treatment like, and the initial treatment like, mm-hmm. and then how did that progress?
It was strange because the actual side effects of the cancer itself was very limited. So it was that day of chest pain, and I felt really weak, and I was tired, and I noticed that kind of between the diagnosis and the beginning of the treatment. So these like 3-ish weeks in between where you're getting a million and one tests, I had 9 surgeries throughout the whole process. I felt like I was getting weaker, but the chemo is really what, I always say this, right? But like, if the cancer doesn't kill you, the chemo is going to kill you. The chemo was miserable. And it was because I was such a good athlete and I was super strong, and they put me in a testing chemo. And so it was a research type thing. So it was 6 rounds of chemo smashed into 3. So you're getting double doses of chemotherapy, and each round is completely different instead of them using the same chemical concoction every time. So the first round, I couldn't keep anything down. And I don't know how graphic you all want me to be on the other side, but I'm just going to leave it at, you can imagine I can't eat a cracker without you seeing the cracker. I couldn't sleep. The insomnia was really, really bad. And I started losing my hair about 10 days in. So, of course, you know, kids with cancer end up bald. So we thought, okay, if we cut the hair, it'll be less heavy and it won't fall out. And that didn't work at all. So I was at the dinner table one day and ran my fingers through my hair. And just had a wad of hair in my hands, ran to my room, started bawling my eyes out. And that was the moment that the cancer was very real to me, because before that it was surgeries and treatment, and I knew it was bad, but I didn't register that I was going to look like the kids that were sick. So now I was sick, but now I looked sick. And I think looking at myself in the mirror every day and seeing the sickness on my face was really quite shocking. And then the second chemotherapy, we had all these different shots and skin rashes and all the, like, everything worse than every movie, you know, that you can see, or every story you've heard when it's happening to you. It's extremely scary. And it puts you in like a funk that you cannot explain, because you know that it's not your fault, but you feel like everything is your fault because your family is sad. You know, your parents are trying not to cry. My mom had to quit her job to take care of me. My grandma flew from Argentina to take care of me. My dad was working all day and then driving 45 minutes to the hospital, staying up with me all night. And so you feel like I'm ruining everybody's life. So it's the physical bad feeling, it's the emotional bad feeling, and then it's watching your family fall apart because you are sick and it's all your fault. I think that's probably the hardest part of the whole thing.
And you're a teenage girl and, you know, yeah, your hair's falling out and you just don't know what to expect from one day to the next. You're getting pumped full of chemicals and, yeah, and all of that stuff. I can pretty much know the answer, but what's your mental state like? What can you bring us back to that point in your life?
I think it's a roller coaster between the fighter and like an elite athlete and the will to want to win and this like champion spirit. I think I had that, but I kept getting knocked down by a giant. It was like going to a boxing ring with Goliath and I'm just a 15-year-old little girl, bald kid, like trying to fight it out, and I'm just getting wrecked by every chemo round was a knockout, you know? And then it kind of gets to the point that you think, this is a pointless battle. There's a 0% chance. I don't care what the doctors say. You have a 70%. When someone tells you you have a 70% chance to live, all you think is 30, I'm dying, right? Because there's a 30% chance. And especially at 15, where maybe my math skills weren't that strong. 30% chance to die sounds like I'm definitely going to die. And I just really had nothing to be excited about. I had nothing to live for. And I didn't see the light at the end of the tunnel at all. So you're in this long tunnel path. You have no idea when it's going to be over. And they just keep walking, keep fighting, keep punching. And you're like, until when? I cannot. And yeah, I did get to the point that I wanted to completely, I was like, it would actually be better if I just died. Better for me, maybe better for my family, because it'd be hard for some time, but then they could move on with their lives. And here we're just stuck in this cancer boxing match every day. Why are we doing this? Yeah, I totally got to the point that I was done.
And your body was in such a weakened condition that it just, none of it mattered, and you never saw a turnaround from that.
No, I couldn't stand in the shower. I remember my mom buying a little bench so that I could sit in the shower. I couldn't stand up for 5 minutes in a row. I couldn't walk from the couch to the bathroom without being completely exhausted. And I just, nobody wants to live like that. Like, especially when you go from playing tournaments, 2-hour matches on a weekend and lifting trophies to not being able to lift yourself off of the toilet. Like, that's a really hard turnaround. And of course, the blinders are on your face and you just think, there's no way, whoever I was before, there's no way I'm going to do that. And this new version of me that I see in the mirror, this like skinny, rash, pale, bald kid, whoever she is, I don't want her either. So if I can't have the old me and I hate the new me, why am I alive?
Why bother?
Yeah.
So you are giving up or giving in?
Yeah, giving up and giving in and tapping out.
And then what happens?
I had this tap out conversation with my parents. This was after my second round of chemo, because my first round, like I mentioned, was bad. The second one I was mortified to go to. So I was really did my best to say, okay, fine, let's get back in the ring. But I didn't want to at all. And I had a breakdown 3 days in the hospital in a dark room where I had a mental, I would call it a mental breakdown, a full panic attack. Fear took over. But we kind of got out of that funk. After the second one, I was like, I actually cannot and will not do this again. So I'm very sassy 15-year-old girl, sit my parents down and say, I love you, but I'm done. So I'm ruining everybody's life. And I had this big speech that I had prepared. And my parents are smart and wise. And they said, we understand you. I don't really remember all of the details of that conversation. But I do remember them saying, just take a few days to think about it. Do you really want to give up on, you're not a quitter, you know? And I think it was a day or two later that Make-A-Wish showed up at my house. And I have never asked them, but I wonder if they didn't already know that. And if it wasn't a little strategic for them to say, wait a second. But anyway, Make-A-Wish shows up at my house. My parents didn't even tell me anybody was coming over. And I got, we got a knock at the door. And it was Danae and Jessica, who still work at Make-A-Wish. And they were there to dream about my future and play a wish game. And I wanted nothing to do with it, Richard. I was like, there's nothing left in this world. There's nothing good to do here. Why are we talking about a future that I'm not going to be living anyway? I was really, Danae will tell you, like, I was sassy. I was angry. And they were patient and kind and played this game with me. Who do you want to meet? Where do you want to go? What do you want to do? And that was the first time I thought about my future being positive in a really long time. So one thing is battling the actual disease that you have in front of you. And one thing is dreaming and thinking beyond what's in front of you. So I had gone to the point that I could fight what was in front of me to a certain degree, but I wasn't at the point that I could look beyond the cancer. There was nothing else but cancer. And then all of a sudden there were dreams and wishes and what if I went and what if I met and what if I could have and where I could go. That was the first time I had thought about anything positive, naturally, organically positive. Versus like pretending I was fine and making myself strong in a really, really, really long time. And we had a lot of fun playing that game. And that game changed my life. And I walked away from that game. They left the house and I looked at my parents and I was like, okay, I'll go to my third round because I can't die before July. I think we met in February, maybe it was February, January. And I was like, I can't die before July because I gotta go. I gotta go to Wimbledon. And they gave me the push that I needed to go into the third round. My parents, to be fair, probably wouldn't have ever let me not go, right? I'm pretty sure it's illegal if you deny your kid. Whatever that was. They were never going to not let me go. But there was a big difference between me wanting the chemo and wanting to live versus me having to get the chemo and convinced that I wasn't going to live. Mm-hmm. So the two rounds of chemo without Make-A-Wish versus the one round of chemo with Make-A-Wish, you can see in the medical records, the three tumors going to one, like from after a few days or whatever it was, the scans that they did. And for me, that was Make-A-Wish. Make-A-Wish literally changed the way that the chemo affected my body because all of a sudden I wanted to live for something.
And so the actual treatment was the same.
Yep.
It's just the effect that it had on you was different.
Yeah, I think the concoction chemo, the third, right, because every round is different for right. the research version, but there wasn't a different dosage. It was just, and none of the other two had really done much of a difference. So after the first one, still three tumors. After the second one, still three tumors. After the third one, one tumor. And they did a couple little extra things that I don't remember at the moment. And then that got rid of the third tumor. And then we did the radiation after that. But the Make-A-Wish chemo was the chemo where the doctor said, this is working, this is going to work, you're going to be okay. And it was the chemo that I wanted to go through and that I was excited. I was like, pump me up, baby. We're like, I got to live. And I really think that that made all the difference. The attitude that I had in the hospital, the wanting to go to chemo, the wanting to get out of it, that was the main difference. And it changed. Even my side effects were different. It didn't affect my body the same way it did the first two times. And I think that's because I had a different mindset going into it.
When did you notice that you were on some road to being, to feeling better? If you know, forget the tumors being reduced or minimized. When did you start saying, this is actually working?
This is good. Wow. That's a hard question because I don't. Right. Even though I've told my story a million times and I am proud of it, there's moments that you block out just because it's easier. But I do remember there was a friend, Fernando, in the hospital, and he was a bit older than me. And he had a brain tumor, and he, I think, was from Ecuador, if I remember correctly. And we were walking. He used to walk around a lot, and I didn't have the energy to walk around at all. And in that third round, I was happier, so I was like, I'll go with you. And what we used to do together was go to the rooms of the children that didn't have parents with them. So there's a lot of kids in the hospital that their parents are working to pay the medical bills and cannot be with them. And we started walking around the hospital and just visiting, playing games, watching DVDs at that time. And I remember he was always doing that, and I never did it with him until the third one. And I think that's when I was like, I can walk. And I was really inspired by him. He ended up not making it and did pass away from his brain cancer. But I will never forget that he lived his last days giving to all the other kids in the hospital. And he taught me to be strong. And because of Make-A-Wish and him, I think I had the will to walk and to do things and to help other people. That's probably where I started feeling it the most. But even when they tell you you're cancer-free, you don't feel normal at all. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not a magical wand that they wave and now all of a sudden your body's good, your hair's back. It doesn't work like that. And so it wasn't until months and months later, I think at Wimbledon, where I was excited and relatively normal. And at Wimbledon, I stopped wearing my wigs. So that was the first trip, the first place I ever went outside without my wigs and without my bandana, because I was very proud to be a cancer survivor, because I was proud to be there with Make-A-Wish.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you, you know, so what was the anticipation of Wimbledon like? You know, it's May, it's June, you know, Wimbledon is coming. You're a few months into that last brutal chemo. What was that anticipation like?
I was excited because my family was excited. So, of course, I wanted to go to Wimbledon, and I was thinking, who's going to be there and what are we going to do? And looking up all the things that we could do in London. And then you had all already given the itinerary of all these cool things that you can be excited about. I remember there was a booklet with like pictures. It was so cool, like a binder. But my parents were excited. And I remember super vividly that my brother was excited about the castle and the sword fighting. He was like, I want a sword fight. My brother hadn't been excited about anything. I mean, for a 7-year-old boy to A, think his sister is going to die, B, be ignored for months and months and months. And the enjoyment of my brother was to do wheelchair races in the hallway with whatever other sibling was available at the time, the super sibs they called themselves. So all of a sudden that he was like looking forward to something, I remember that a lot. And my mom taking me shopping to get new clothes for the trip and picking out the outfits. It sounds silly, but I had basically worn pajamas for a year. And all of a sudden, I was picking my Wimbledon clothes. That's surreal.
I can't imagine what it was like. Well, you can tell us what it was like when you walked the grounds of Wimbledon.
I was shaking. I get emotional now. When we walked up to the gate and it said Wimbledon on the thing. And my whole body was shaking, and I was like, I'm here. And then you had all got us like special ground pass access or something. So we got to go to the court before the matches were on, and we were on the court. And I just couldn't believe that I was there, and I could smell and see and like almost taste the atmosphere, and just thinking like, I can die now. Like, I was actually kind of, not that I wanted to die, because I no longer wanted to die, but I was like, if I never do anything else, like, I live, this is my dream. I've always wanted to play and win Wimbledon, and I might never play, but like, I'm here. And I wouldn't say, I don't think anything would make being sick worth it, right? Or like living it again. I would never live it again for the wish, if I'm being really honest.
Right.
Loved my wish, but I wouldn't do it again for the wish. But the fact that I would consider doing it again for the wish, I think says a lot. And that I had that moment of like, okay, we're here. Like, maybe it was worth it. Even the maybe it was worth it for this one singular moment, I think is crazy that you could even get to that mental space because of a wish.
What do you remember about the matches there?
We saw Federer play. That was the year that Nadal and Federer played like a 5-hour final. And we watched it at Chili's because we had landed like the day before or something like that. And I won't ever forget watching it at the Chili's. But we had watched Federer We saw a bunch of the players warming up, which was the coolest thing in the world. And I remember going with my dad one day. We had one day tickets, just the two of us, and one day tickets, the four of us. And the day that I went with my dad alone was a really beautiful moment because he had been my coach and my trainer and kind of my number one. My mom, too, of course, is my number one fan. But, you know, my dad was like my coach. And being there with him after he had spent so many sleepless nights cutting apples because it was the only thing that I could eat. All of a sudden, we were eating the strawberries and cream together at the dream tournament. I won't ever forget that. And his face of joy and the hugs that he gave me. And the it was like, I think one of the most magical moments we've ever had as a family. And we still, 17 years later, talk about it. Every Thanksgiving, like, what are you thankful for? Make-A-Wish is on that list of our whole life. Every Christmas, every, like, when we go on a cruise or a holiday and we're like, where does this rank on the trips? I don't think anyone has beat Make-A-Wish in all the trips because Wimbledon's always top three. And sometimes we can't decide. And then we're like, was it better than Wimbledon? Is anything ever going to be better than that trip? I actually don't think so.
Well, you answered my question because we do hear this, that Wish families talk about, you know, that time being together. But what's interesting is a lot of the Wish families talk about different things, different aspects of it. Sometimes it's just togetherness. It's not even about where you are. You could be anywhere. But it's just the togetherness. It's eating meals together. It's not crying together. It's laughing together. It's traveling and all that stuff. What was it besides Wimbledon, and that's the hallowed ground for you, what made that so special? What made this so special for everybody else who might not have been as into tennis as you were?
Yeah, I think that everyone being happy at the same time, that doesn't exist when you're sick. So there's a guilt, I think, for people being, when your parents can't be happy. I'm not a parent, but I can imagine if it was even my brother Max, how could you be happy when the person you love the most is dying? I think that for a year or more, there's a no happiness at all. There's maybe hope, there's maybe gratitude for someone still being alive, but genuine joy doesn't really exist. So all being happy at the same time, I think, is a mega moment. Being able to spend money and it not be a burden, I think also when families are going through financial hardships because of the medical bills and the medication on the side and all these different things, I don't think my parents enjoyed or couldn't spend money on anything outside of the survival of the family during that time. And we still always talk about this. My mom got a $50 hair blowout, like, for the day that we were going to the matches. And my mom was like obsessed with her hair. And I'm like, thinking it's not a big deal. I'm like, Mom, you spent $50 for Wimbledon. Like, who cares what your hair looks like? We look at the pictures and we're like, Mom, your hair looks fabulous. But it's because she hadn't spent any money on herself in a year. She hadn't bought anything for herself. She hadn't done her hair, hadn't done her nails, because how could you do anything but take care of your kid? We went to Starbucks, which is my dad and my favorite place to go on our dates together. But the four of us sitting at Starbucks in London was crazy because there was a Starbucks in the hospital and my dad would spend hours there by himself and bring me stuff sometimes, but I couldn't even go down there because I couldn't survive that walk. And all of a sudden, we're not in the hospital Starbucks. We're in the London Starbucks, the four of us, about to go to this tennis championship. Like, I can't even really explain what that feels like.
Have you ever considered going back?
I have gone back to London. Oh, okay. Yeah. I haven't gone back to Wimbledon.
Okay.
But I have gone back to London a few times. And it's one of my favorite cities to visit because it has the best memories ever for me.
Those memories whoosh back like nothing else.
Yeah, 100%. Every time I see the double-decker tour buses, I'm like, oh, we did one. And I remember sitting in the top and it was a beautiful day and just feeling like this is the coolest thing. I'm on a double-decker tour bus and my mom still has, she has a spoon collection, so she still has the London spoon and it's very prominent in the front of the spoon collection. We all are obsessed with that trip, with those memories. And my brother still remembers, he was 7 or 8, but he remembers going to the castle and doing the bow and arrow. He remembers running up the steps. He remembers going by Buckingham Palace. I think those memories are ingrained in us forever.
And then after your wish, we recognized something in you that said, this could be an amazing ambassador for us. So we started asking you to speak on our behalf, to speak to these very important groups and these very important fundraisers, because we knew you had a story to tell. And I know Make-Wish, you have told us many times how Make-Wish is an important part of your life. Can you talk about your post-Wish ambassadorship of Make-A-Wish and why you felt like it was important? I mean, we wanted you to because of your amazing personality and story, but why was it important for you to give back that way?
There's something that happens when you're done with being sick, quote unquote, done with being sick, that everyone tells you you're back to normal, you can live your normal life, and you're just trying to move on with your life. And the cancer needs to be now a part of your past that you may or may not bring up ever again in your life, and you try to forget it. And then being an ambassador forces you in a positive way to revisit the most difficult time in your life and make peace with it and use that to make an impact and propel forward. So it does give you a maybe this is why I got sick moment, which anyone who's gone through, I think, a life-threatening illness, maybe it's just me, okay, but I highly doubt it. Why me? Why did this happen when you're sick? And then when you survive it, why me? Why do I get to live and Fernando doesn't get to live? Why am I healthy and other kids don't make it? And you feel like it's called survivor's guilt. I've gone through a lot of it in therapy. And Make-A-Wish fills this hole in your heart that's like, why do I have a second chance and what am I doing with that second chance? Through Make-A-Wish and through raising funds, I was like, maybe I got sick so that I can help fundraise so that other kids that are sick can have a wish and can have a healed heart and mind. Because your body can be healed, but your mind and your heart are not necessarily healed. Right. And Make-A-Wish helped heal our whole family. And through the ambassadorship, I think it gave me purpose in my sickness. I'm still 17 years later, 16 years later, asking myself why and what am I doing with my chance? I think I'll always be asking that question. But Make-A-Wish has filled a hole and a space that when I'm deep in the what am I doing with my second chance at life, I always think I'm helping kids and maybe that's why. So the ambassadorship helped heal me, essentially. That's what I think it did. And it gave me a chance to talk about my story, to enjoy life again, to meet incredible people. And it's built a family that I never know that I needed, like Brenda and Sherry and Joe and Jessica and Danae and Mary and Jackie and you and Norm and all these people in my life that Marina, the other Marina as well, right? Like I would never have met you. And you've all been integral parts of my entire quote-unquote adulthood, right? Like from 15 to now 31, you've all been in award ceremonies, my wedding, supported me through my divorce. Like you've been there in every most important part of my life, moving to Germany. When I come home and visit, you all are there. And it's given me a family and it's given me a purpose and it's given me a voice for a story that I didn't want to tell, but a story that essentially has changed my life and hopefully impacted other families and other kids along the way.
And you're 16 years cancer-free now.
Yes, I am, as of March 23rd.
Okay, celebrated an anniversary.
Yeah.
And each year when you celebrate that anniversary, you give credit to the people who have helped you along those 16 years.
Yeah.
Can you talk about those groups of people that you single out?
Absolutely. So, and my Instagram will be a testament to this. If you go back every year my cancer-free anniversary, I do a post. And every year, Make-A-Wish is in my post. That maybe they're the same pictures. People are getting tired of seeing them. I don't care. They're my favorite pictures. I always give credit to the doctors who worked extremely hard to figure out how to beat my cancer, my family, and Make-A-Wish. Those are the three groups of people I always mention. Because there is no, for me, in my heart, I truly believe there is no cancer-free if there's no Make-A-Wish for me. And there is no healing, there is no recovery, there is no reconciliation of why without Make-A-Wish. So I cannot tell my cancer story without telling my Make-A-Wish story.
What would you say to somebody who may have a skepticism about the impact that a wish has on a child, on a child's family, on a child's you know, their community, their orbit, people around them. You know, there could be some skepticism of, okay, we gave a child a wish and we moved along, they moved along, and then we moved on to something else. We know that's not the case, and you're the testament to why that is not the case. What would you tell that person?
I would say, if for them to think of their own favorite memory in their life, whether that's a hardship or a moment of joy, that moment is relived again and again and again, right? And that's for a normal person without a disease. Maybe it comes back to them in their dreams or on a special date of the year they remember. So take that, amplify it by 20,000, and then extend that from you as an individual to an entire family and orbit of people who were affected by a child's disease. If you're an adult and you're looking at a child and saying, oh, that's nice, they swam with the dolphins, or they went on a cruise, that's a nice day, that's a nice week. What that family had to go through to get to that nice day, that might have been that kid's only nice day in 5 years. That might have been that family's only nice week in months and months and months. That alone is good enough. But if that's not good enough for you and you're still skeptical about that, that wish lives on and on and on in every cancer-free anniversary and every Thanksgiving and every special holiday. In every memory of the cancer comes the memory of the wish. And it's like a black wall that you get to paint full of color every single time that you remember that scary thing. So I would say, step out of your own box and your own mind and think about how the wish goes beyond the day, beyond the memory, and beyond the week, and steps into, 16 years of my life. And I cannot not cry when I think of my wish, or smile when I think of my wish. And it not only impacts, you as an individual and your family and the healing process, but it changes you as a person because it heals your skepticism of this world is a terrible place and it's death and fear and pain. You have strangers who are willing to give their money and their hard-earned money for you to enjoy a day. And it heals this, the world is a terrible place feeling. And when you're a kid and you realize the world is scary and sad, it's really scary. Because you have an adult thought in a 15-year-old or a 10-year-old body or mind, and it heals that. So you taking a little bit of your time and effort and energy or talents, you know, whatever it is, to donate to a foundation that's going to change a kid's life, not for a day, not for a week, but for 16 years and 30 years, heal their heart and mind. I don't know what you could be skeptical about that. That's a forever impact. There's very few things in your life that will impact you forever. And Make-A-Wish impacts you and your family forever. And my career is also different because of Make-A-Wish, and we could talk about that or not a different time or now, whatever. But I'm literally a different person because of being an ambassador for Make-A-Wish. The confidence I have as a person, the pride I have about my cancer, the impact I've been able to make through the foundation and raising money, standing on stages and speaking to people, interacting with incredible donors and families, like that's changed me as a human. And there's, for me, nothing outside of a wish that maybe faith, and a wish. Those are the two things that can stay with you your entire life, because nothing lasts forever. No relationship, no friendship, no job. But for me, Make-A-Wish lasts forever.
You've talked a little bit about what you're doing with your life now. So tell us, you're 31, you're living in Germany. You're a public speaker, outside of your job, but tell us what you're doing with your life now.
Yes, I am living in Germany for almost 4 years now, and I'm the global director of diversity and inclusion for a logistics company. I love what I do. I've been in the HR space for 12 years because I started working quite young, and I love it. I went to college, I played tennis in college, and now I'm living, I would say I'm surviving. I don't know if I'm thriving, Richard, but I'm surviving as an adult. I love my life in Germany. I love my family. We're all healthy and happy, and really just trying to maintain this, making an impact throughout my life. I think I got a taste of that with Make-A-Wish, and I try to use it in everything that I do. And I think that's part of why I chose my career, is because it's a career that I really think I can make an impact on people's lives, and I want to do that. So I'm doing that as much as I can at work, and then as much as I can on the side. I have the pleasure and privilege of speaking at conferences, camps, conventions, meetings, workshops, whatever it is, on many different topics. But one of my favorites to discuss is identity and resilience. Those are my two favorites. And of course, Make-A-Wish is part of both of those speeches and stories.
Well, you are obviously a resilient person, and you know, what you have given to us is as valuable as what we've given to you. And on a personal level, just to know somebody like you, it's funny, when you were speaking for us as a teenager, I said to a couple of people, including Norm, I said, if I could buy stock in a person, I'd buy stock in Marina.
Oh, gosh.
And just, your amazing advocacy for us has been such a godsend for us. And we really do appreciate you and appreciate you being here on this podcast and the story that you tell. And hopefully the people that are listening to this will be able to tell that story to another person. Mm-hmm. And then that person will tell that story to another person. And, and we'll be able to pay it forward on, the great work that Make-A-Wish does and the impact that we've had on you and your life and your family's life and everybody surrounding you. So thank you for being here. Thank you for your amazing ambassadorship for us and your advocacy for us. And it's been great to know you over the years, and we appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Richard. I love you. I love Make-A-Wish, and I'll be here for the next however many years I'm alive, continuing to speak out the impact of a wish. And thanks for having me.
Thanks to Marina, and thank you for listening to A World of Wishes produced by Make-A-Wish Southern Florida. To learn more about how you can help create more inspiring stories like Marina's, visit us at wish.org/SFLA. We also ask for your help in supporting this podcast by rating, reviewing, and subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. And tell a friend. You can also listen to our archive shows at worldofwishespodcast.org.